What's up, my friends? Welcome back to the Pilgrimage Podcast. For those waking up to the wonder in all things, celebrating truth and beauty, seeking to live fully here, fully present, fully human. This intro might feel a little different. Well, that's because this episode is a little different. You know, I couldn't let this year end without doing the Pilgrimage Podcast Christmas special. Yes. I'm not gonna lie, man, this track has got me hyped up. Ready to drop some Christmas bars. It's time for some Christmas rapping. Dad jokes. I can say that now, I'm a dad, I'm gonna be a dad. You might have seen that. You might have seen the announcement that my wife and I, Kara, are expecting a baby next year, June 2020. Appreciate all the love and kindness that you've been sharing over socials. Next year, come on, there is a baby on the way. And we know that actually works as a very nice little segue interlude into this here Christmas special, because, well, this time of year, when it rolls around, we all start talking about celebrating, gathering around the story of little baby Jesus. Yes, that transition was incredible. And I wanted to spend some time in reflection of that story, because I try each year to allow my space, allow myself space and time to dig a little deeper into this story, so that when this season approaches, I feel a little more connected to why we make such a big deal out of it. And this year, I thought, instead of keeping those reflections to myself, I'll jump up on this mic and share them with you, because I think we need to take moments like this to really be in the seasons that we celebrate. They're so familiar to us that we can become so disconnected from them, ironically. And this story, although it's ancient, really couldn't be more profound in the way that it relates to our society and culture at large today. It is simple, yet subversive. It is scandalous. It is utterly scandalous. It is far more fitting for a late night drama TV show than it is a little primary school nativity play. But we'll get onto that in a second. The only thing I ask is, as I get into these ancient texts, into these scriptures, and into these thoughts, the only thing I ask is that you would allow yourself to hear these words and these stories afresh, that you wouldn't be so aware of how the story goes and how it ends and what happens that you would kind of conclude the message, but you would actually just allow yourself to hear it a little different this time. So I'm going to jump straight into one of the Gospels. It's the Gospel of Matthew, where the story of Jesus's birth is first mentioned and read to us. And this is, again, this is an ancient text. This is one of the gospel writers, one of the disciples of Jesus, telling the story of how Christ came to earth, Emmanuel. And it's in the manner that he writes that so much detail and drama is added into the story and into our ability to connect with what happened. This is a story about God becoming man, about the divine being wrapped in human expression, so that he could meet us where we are in all that we're going through. And it's just very, very beautiful. So it says this. This is in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, verse 18. It says, "Now this is how the birth of Jesus took place. There's something about that which kind of stops me in my reading. Now, this is how the birth of Jesus took place. When was the last time someone, when you looked at their baby and said how cute it was, decided to tell you how the birth took place? We have enough connection with what happens in those rooms that we don't really want to know too much more detail. The baby's born. That's all we need to know. Now, Matthew says this is how his birth took place, as if right from the get-go, there's something a little different, more interesting, right? There's a little more drama in this story than you might have thought. He says, now this is how the birth of Christ took place. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, when Mary had got engaged to Joseph, before they came together, which is a very lovely biblical way of saying before they had sex and they got married, she was found to be with child. She was found to be with child, conceived of the Holy Spirit. Before they got married, before they had slept together, Mary was found to be pregnant with a child that had been given to her through divine intervention. So verse 9, her husband Joseph, being a good and just man, unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly. Now, this is the first kind of dramatic point in the story. Mary gets pregnant before she gets married. Now, I know if that happened today, it's no big deal. But thousands of years ago, we're in the first century, when this story is taking place, there really couldn't be anything worse from a societal point of view, a moral point of view, than getting pregnant before you get married. Marriage, for the Jews in the first century, marriage is just the highest ideal. It represents commitment, covenant. It's holy, it's revered, it's set apart. And when a couple got engaged, they were as good as married, in the sense that if one of them died, the other would become a widow, a widower, you know? There was a bond that had been formed in their intention to get married that was far transcendent of even the way that we would view marriage today. So although they're just engaged, that bond from a cultural point of view is set in place. And the fact that Mary is now pregnant before they're married, pregnant by some means other than Joseph, is utterly devastating from a reputation kind of standpoint. So Leviticus chapter 20 verse 10, which is the law, the moral code from which the Jews were living from, that said that if a man or a woman was caught in adultery, the punishment would be death. So when it says her husband Joseph, being a just man, was unwilling to put her to shame, it again is provocative, because the justice that was fit for such a crime as adultery was death. But the text says, Joseph, being a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, chose to divorce her quietly. It's as if Joseph had this sense about him which was transcendent of the law itself, because what he did wasn't actually justice in relation to the law. It was a deeper, compassionate form of justice, so to speak. He said, what you've done is wrong, I'm going to divorce you, but I'm not going to do it in such a way that you are ridiculed and you are ultimately put to death. But, says verse 20, as he considered these things, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not fear to take Mary as your wife, for that which is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. You will call him Jesus. The name Jesus means Savior. You will call him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Verse 22, all of this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the prophet, which was written 800 years ago. It said, behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. Now, when I read this story, the first question that erupts within me is, why so scandalous, right? Like, why does the story have to be so embedded in a scandal? Could it not have been that God could find a way to become in human expression without it being the origin of his story being a scandal. I mean, he surely could have just rocked up as a teenager and been adopted by Mary and Joseph, or even just appeared for the first time as an adult man. But no, he decides to come not only as a child, but a child born in the midst of what would have been an outright scandal. If the culture, the community had just viewed Joseph as being in the wrong, i.e. Joseph sleeping with his fiance before they were married, then, you know, it's scandalous. If it's Mary having an affair, then it's a scandal. There's no way around it not being a scandal. It is embedded in the story. And, you know, one of the answers is, well, is, you know, it's theological. Jesus was both the Son of God and the Son of Man. In the New Testament alone, he's called the Son of God 24 times and the Son of Man 83 times. And so without the virgin birth, we can't establish Jesus as being God with us. If Joseph or anyone had been the father, then Jesus would have just been another man. So the virgin birth does, you know, create this theological argument for why Jesus is both Son of Man and Son of God, but it's still a scandal. Surely it didn't have to be so provocative in that sense. And the answer for me is actually in the verses before we have this story, because the writer of this gospel, Matthew, he lays out the genealogy of Jesus all the way back to the beginning, the genealogy of Jesus, who his forefathers and mothers were. And we find out in this story of Jesus' origin that it's riddled with people caught in scandal, adulterers, murderers, thieves, prostitutes, people that would have been scorned by their society for their actions and for what they were involved in. Matthew makes it clear that the way that God entered through into the human race was far from sanitized, let's say, in its nature, but decorated with chaos and problems and drama. And I love it because I look at his genealogy and I think, man, I think that's how a lot of us feel about our own families. Drama, man, this isn't just like clean cut. This is messy, and this is so representative of family in the manner in which we experience family today. And the more I've thought about this story, this Christmas story and how it begins, the more I realize that the beginning really informs the rest of Jesus's ministry, his teaching, his expression of what it means to be truly human on earth. See, later in the gospel, there's a story in the book of John, chapter 8, where Jesus is teaching and a woman is brought to Jesus who is caught in a scandal. She's actually been caught in the act. It says she was caught in the act of adultery. And so this woman, not the man, just the woman, is brought into the temple where Jesus is teaching, and she's thrown in front of him. And the Pharisees, these religious leaders, in an attempt to kind of catch Jesus in heresy, say to him, the law of Moses, that, as I just read out at the beginning, says a woman caught in adultery should be put to death. What should we do? Testing Jesus in the sense, will he uphold our ancient law, or is he, in his kind of heretical expression, gonna assume he has a better way? And he says to them, okay, well, if that's what the law says, then he who is without sin cast the first stone. So if you want to kill this woman for sinning, he who is without sin cast the first stone. And it then says the men began to leave, the oldest men first. And it's just Jesus and this woman left. And the woman looks to Jesus and he says to her, woman, who here condemns you? And she says, no one. That's right. He says, so get up and leave your life of sin. Leave a life that disturbs the peace that is available to live within every day. Leave it. Leave the chaos behind you. And it's so profound because Jesus expresses a new compassion, and could I say a new justice, a new way of relating to one another is expressed in this very powerful story. And as I read the story, I realize, man, Jesus knew what it was to have scandal around him. He wasn't shocked, right? He wasn't shocked when people would be presented to him in their pain and in their mess and in their chaos, because in fact, his very origin was stamped with such a story itself. His mother, for all of her days, would have been known as the woman who got pregnant before she got married. Man, that's scandalous. So whether or not people believed her that an angel told her it was God given, or whether or not people believed Joseph, there would have been a mark on her as the woman who got pregnant before she got married. Jesus would have known what it was to grow up with rumors and conversations happening about his own family. He would have known what it was like to be marked as the child that was born outside of wedlock. It's so, so powerful. It's really, really important to acknowledge that Jesus's compassion to us isn't some sanitized, theoretical, well-read, intellectual expression of what to do when you find someone in crisis. It's actually an outworking of his own experience. Jesus was called God with us, Emmanuel, for a reason. He hasn't come to save us from a position of being outside of our experiences, but saving us from within them. It's very different when you have someone next to you who's been through what you've been through, as they give you words of comfort and perspective. When you know the person that is reaching you has stood where you've stood, has sat where you've sat, has suffered like you have suffered, has failed like you have failed, you feel a sense of oneness and unity that is transcendent of someone who hasn't been there. Jesus reveals to us from the very beginning of his time on earth to the very end that he is fully embracing of the human experience. We know that ultimately from what he experiences on the cross. Jesus dies a bloody, torturous, painful death. He is betrayed. He gets lonely. He becomes anxious. He grieves. He weeps so deeply that it says he began to sweat blood before he died. Jesus is fully embracing of the human experience. It says in the book of Romans, it says that all people have fallen short of the glory of God. All people have missed the mark. And I don't think you need a Bible verse to tell you that's true. I think you know it of yourself, I certainly do, and of the people around me. And it's not a condemning word, it's actually enlightening to say, you know what? I haven't fully measured up to the kind of most beautified and revealed experience of what it means to be a human. I haven't got there yet. But Jesus is revealing to me every single day that one, I'm not alone in it, and two, there's a better way to live. When we receive the truth that God meets us in our mess, we'll have compassion for people in theirs. Emmanuel means that God isn't waiting for us on the other side of getting better, having it all together. Emmanuel doesn't meet us on the other side of our sickness being conquered, of our grades getting better, of our accomplishments being succeeded. He isn't waiting for you to become the person that you have in your mind when you think of the best version of yourself. He is with you right now. The birth of Jesus happened in this way. Scandalous. Why? Because we all relate to that in one way or another. It might not have been something that was publicly made known, something that everyone is aware of, but you know in your life. You know where you feel exposed, where you feel less than. And could it be that the Christmas story is reminding us that we're not alone in it? And not only that, but our stories, as scandalous as they are, could be what helps someone else feel less alone in their mess and in their chaos. I think that's so beautiful. I think that's so profound, because for me, there is such a temptation to move past my shortcomings and my falling downs, my failures, to reach that perceived image of what I'd like to be in the future, forgetting the whole time that it's in the embracing of our weakness, in the embracing of our dependency, that we make a pathway for other people in theirs. The Apostle Paul writes in Corinthians 12, I believe it is, he says, he's talking about a lifelong struggle, and he says, you know, but I boast now about my weakness, because the power of God is made perfect in my weakness. And so I'm going to boast even more because grace, it turns out, is sufficient. And there's something about just letting go of the facade and letting go of the need to be picture perfect that actually helps you access true power, true divine power, rather than a performance that you have to keep up every day of your life that is just, you know, breaking your shoulders with the sheer weight of it, to say, you know what, this is where I'm weak and I'm going to boast about it. I really struggle with X. I really find this difficult. But in acknowledging that and in announcing it, I'm making a pathway for power that isn't my own to be revealed and to be accessed. You know, it can be a really practical thing when you let someone else know something that you can't do very well and they're able to step in and help you with it. Honestly, like this year alone, I've come to the end of myself in a number of things that I've upheld to try and perfect and try and perform in such a way that it became so burdensome, I just couldn't do it anymore. I've had it in business and I've had it in my personal life, and it's been in sharing it with friends. I've got two or three friends I share these weaknesses with. I don't just share my weaknesses, I've learned to boast in my weaknesses, because then they're able to get around me and help me and build these beautiful roads and pathways to divine power, so I can be someone that I could never have been if it was all on my shoulders. You know, the second thing about this provocative Christmas story is this. The birth of Jesus is this earth-shattering, you know, tectonic plate-shifting spiritual awakening. It's this moment that redefines history from whatever angle you read it and perceive it. And when it happened, it's as if heaven gave out invitations. And the people that were invited, again, just make this story even more scandalous. The story goes like this. When Jesus was about to be born, angels went around the region and invited some shepherds. It says this in Luke chapter 2. It says, "And in the same region there were shepherds in a field, keeping watch over their flocks. And an angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were filled with fear." These angels were invited to go and witness Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us, the sovereign king in human flesh. And I always grew up, you know, seeing that as this lovely little part of the story that the shepherds got involved in. I got to play the shepherd in the Christmas play and all that kind of stuff. But it's only recently that I've realized how subversive that part of the story is, how important it is, and how it has an impact on our life and on our culture today. Because the shepherds shouldn't have been invited to such a historic royal affair. Why? Because the shepherds were very low down in the society kind of the time. They were at the bottom of the bottom. They weren't viewed as respectable, trustworthy people. Traditionally, shepherding in Judaism had been a kind of a noble vocation because the patriarchs of the faith had practiced shepherding. But when the Israelites moved to Egypt, they migrated to Egypt and were there for 400 years, the view of what it was to be a shepherd changed because of a prejudice that the Egyptians had towards shepherds, being that they were farmers and shepherds was a more nomadic lifestyle. And it didn't really work with farming because the sheep would eat the farmers, you know, land that they were cultivating. And so shepherds were looked down upon. Actually, in Genesis, Joseph, who's one of, like, you know, the brothers that move into Egypt and represent the tribes of Israel, he says to his brothers in Genesis 46, he says, every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. So over the 400 years that the Israelites are in Egypt, there is this growing sense of being a shepherd is less than, it, you know, it is an ostracized, exiled kind of practice. And so when they move back to their homeland, shepherding isn't revered like it once was. It doesn't have the same status. So I actually read this commentary by a Lutheran theologian, and he wrote this. I thought this was very interesting. He said, "Shepherding lost its widespread appeal. It eventually forfeited its social acceptability. And some shepherds did earn their poor reputations, but others became victims of a cruel stereotype. The religious leaders poisoned the shepherd's good name, and rabbis banned pasturing sheep and goats in the land. It wasn't until about 1000 BC when King David was born and raised into his kingship that shepherding slightly got a good name again. But it was actually the fact that David was a shepherd that made his rise to king so profound. 2 Samuel 7:8 says, "I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, this nomadic lifestyle, that you should be prince over my people." It was like the underdog story that David went from being a shepherd to a king, right? And so you fast forward all the way to the birth of Jesus, and you realize that actually what we have here in the story is again scandalous. The theologian says, as we gaze upon the nativity scene, and we smile at those gunny sack shepherds, let's not lose sight of the striking irony. A handful of shepherds, marginalized by the social and religious elite, were chosen to break the silence of centuries, heralding the Messiah's birth. It is a significant decision to hand such a pivotal part as testifying to the incarnation to such unreliable witnesses. But then it mirrors Jesus' eccentric choice of disciples and his delivery of the task of living out the gospel to flawed people like us. The Christmas story reveals that the good news, the true expression of God and the true expression of man, is available to everyone. In fact, the people that get the front row seat in the story of Christmas are not the people that we would expect. It isn't the religious leaders that get an invitation. It's the shepherds. It's the wandering nomads. And not only is it them, but we learn in the story as it goes on that these men from the East, the studiers of stars, these astronomers, get an invitation to walk 1,000 miles to the birthplace of Christ. Now, traditionally, you know it as the three kings. We think it's three kings because of the three gifts, but we really don't know how many men came. What we do know is that they studied space and they followed a star for about 1,000 miles to get to where Jesus was. What is so powerful about them getting the invitation to witness the birth of the Messiah, the promised child, the promised expression of God on earth, prophesied 800 years ago. What was so scandalous about them getting the invitation is they weren't even Jews. They didn't know the story. They weren't a part of the lineage. They had no real connection to the story. They were the others. Do you hear me when I say that? They are the others. They're the people that you've written off. They're the people that shouldn't have access to the promise. They're the people that have been judged. They're the people with the crazy ideas, the ways of seeing the world that we scorn, because they're heathens, man. They're pagans, man. They don't have what we have. They don't have our enlightenment. They don't have our revelation. They haven't studied as we study. They don't have our intellect. They have a whole different way of seeing the world. Yes, says God. The divine. He says yes, and they are going to have a front row seat. I'm going to entrust the message to them. Why? Because from the beginning of Jesus's life, from his birth unto his death, every expression of his humanity reveals to us, just because you know it all, just because you have the right ideas, just because you have the right words to say, just because you've grown up in the tradition, just because you have the intellect, doesn't mean you have the heart of God. Because God is revealed in our humility, in our compassion, and in our unapologetic, unreserved, unflinching desire to love. Jesus tells these stories over and over again. He talks about the thief and the Pharisee, the religious leader and the thief coming to pray. Both pray, but he says, who does God hear? God hears the thief because he prays an honest prayer. This Christmas story is upsetting for you and for I if there is judgment in our life, if we believe that people have to look like, behave like, think like, believe like us in order for us to love them and to trust them. The Christmas story does not empower us to be religious and dogmatic in the expression of our spirituality, but it leads us to be compassionate. humble and kind, because the good news, the coming news of Christ, was given to unsuspecting, right? Untrusted people. I don't want to miss out. And what I hear from this story is that it's our humility that attracts the divine to entrust us with good news. The Christmas story should remind our humanity that it's in our humility we get to bear witness to divine intervention. I think that is so powerful and so beautiful. When we say Emmanuel, we are saying that God is with us, not in theory, but in practice, with us in our mess, with us in our chaos, with us in our scandal, with us in our otherness, in our written offness, in our being judged, in our being condemned, in our feeling not good enough, in our falling down and failures. That is who God is with us. And so when we say, O come, Emmanuel, we're saying, oh God, would you make it so clear to us? Would we become increasingly convinced of your presence with us in our present, whatever it looks like? Maybe you're gearing up to this Christmas season with trepidation and fear because this Christmas season represents loss and loneliness to you. Perhaps it represents lack. And I just want to speak to you listening to this podcast and say that is why we celebrate each year. Because at some time or another, for all of us on this human journey, we need to know that there is a divine presence that fills the gaps, that meets us in the spaces that we can't even face. That is what Christmas is all about. You know, I'd love to end this Christmas special with a short prayer that my friend Doug McKelvey wrote in his book, Every Moment Holy. It's so beautiful. It's a prayer of calling out, of crying out to Emmanuel, God with us. And I think it would be the perfect way to end this here Christmas special. O come, Emmanuel, Christ our King, how we long for your return. O come, Emmanuel, Christ our Shepherd, how we pine for your voice. O come, Emmanuel, Christ our older brother, how we miss you. Make haste, O Lord, return to us. Remembering, O Christ, that you regarded our helpless estate and came to dwell amongst us as the promised fulfillment of all holy desires. We turn our hearts now to remember your works. You came to us, O Lord, as a lantern in our darkness. Now illuminate our way. You came to us, O Christ, as a song in the midst of our sorrow, now kindle our hope. You came to us as a balm on the bed of our suffering, now be our healing. You came to us as a shelter in the middle of the storms, now grant us peace. You came to us as mercy in the place of our shame, now be our righteousness. You came to us as a king upon the fields of our defeat, now be our salvation. And you came to us as a child in the midnight of our despair, now be our God. Remembering these manifold joys and blessings of your first advent, how our hearts long to witness the glories of your promised return. Come quickly, Lord Jesus. O come, Emmanuel.